welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working from home on this pre-recorded program, very remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, January 27, 2021. Sudanese are back on the streets protesting against the prices of bread and fuel.
She says, as we speak today, there are people in government institutions and even those who are in charge of our bread and cooking gas are elements from the previous Bashir administration. This government has neglected to remove them, hold them accountable, and try them for the criminals that they are.
And authorities in Jonglei State expelled two bishops from the Episcopal Church of South Sudan.
The people who are loyal to him are the ones who block us from the airport. When we went to the airport, they were protesting. Maybe they wanted to fight us.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Tens of thousands of Sudanese have staged another wave of street protests in the capital Khartoum and across towns in Sudan to protest the high cost of living, including the price hikes of bread, fuel and electricity. The editor-in-chief of the online Khartoum Today newspaper, Mohammed Al-Fazari, says different groups participating in the latest protest are demanding economic reforms or the removal of the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. For VOA News, Nabil Biyaju reports from Washington.
Protesters have been marching and chanting on the streets of Khartoum and other cities in Sudan for days now. They burned tires and blocked some roads in Khartoum to protest the high costs of bread, electricity and fuel. Sahar Al-Juzuli is a member of Al-Kalakla Abu Adam Resistance Committee, a grassroots group that participated in organizing the protests. She says the protests have basically never stopped since the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir in April 2019. Speaking in Arabic, she says, the demands that we have been making since the time of President Bashir are still the same, and the high cost of living is at the top of them. And these demonstrations going on right now are a riot that we earned through our civilian revolution. The transitional government recently removed fuel subsidies, sparking price hikes and acute shortages in bread and electricity. Many Sudanese cannot afford to buy bread or have to queue for several hours outside bakeries to buy it. Sahar blames the government for not taking decisive action to remove certain individuals from the previous administration, whom she says are responsible in part for the current crisis. She says, as we speak today, there are people in government institutions and even those who are in charge of our bread and cooking gas are elements from the previous Bashir administration. This government has neglected to remove them, hold them accountable, and try them for the criminals that they are. Mohammed Ali Fazari, editor-in-chief of the online newspaper Khartoum Today, says, the protests are not just in the capital Khartoum, but have spread across Sudan.
Al-Fashir, the capital city of Northern Darfur City, in Blue Nile State, the city of Damazin, and many other cities. And they have the same demands that the high prices of electricity, bread, and other basic commodities is the key issue that make the people get out on the streets once again, and also raising their demands, downfall of the government and all others. Ask for immediate economic reform.
Fazari says besides the grassroots resistance committees, there are several forces participating in the latest protests to achieve different agendas.
There are many parties that are involved in that protest, and among them that is the Sudanese Professional Association, which in the past was the key player of moving the protest in the streets. And the other group is also the Communist Party and other that against the policy on the economic policy of the government. And the other group which has other agenda like the Islamists and the followers of ousted regime.
Fazari and Al-Juzuli say followers of former President Omar al-Bashir are looking to exploit the protests to undermine Sudan's transitional government and create chaos. But the overwhelming majority of protesters are on the streets to demand better living conditions, not to remove the government. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biyaju in Washington.
The Dutch ambassador to South Sudan says the slow implementation of the revitalized peace agreement is affecting Dutch-funded development programs in South Sudan. Ambassador Jelta van Weyeren says the smooth implementation of the peace deal could rescue the humanitarian situation in the country. For VOA News, Onan Walter Solomon reports from Juba.
In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ambassador Weyeren says the violence across parts of the country is affecting several development programs in South Sudan. He says that the Dutch government urges all parties to continue to strive to fully implement the deal.
We believe that peace is a necessary prerequisite for enhancing the situation of all the people of South Sudan. So if there's no peace, it's going to be very difficult to stimulate any development.
Van Weyeren says that the Netherlands has been involved in a number of cases where there were development gains in the past, only to be destroyed by violence.
That is our major concern anywhere, because that's prerequisite number one. The second one, of course, is climatic conditions. If you work in food security, if you work in water, if you work in fisheries, climate change and resulting erratic weather behavior like torrential rains and floods are extremely influential and very detrimental to what we do.
Van Weyeren calls it unfortunate that some protocols of the agreement have been delayed, saying it will take the country's leaders longer to restore complete peace. He urged the parties to ask for help from the international community if they are deadlocked on issues they cannot resolve on their own.
If there are issues in the peace agreement that are difficult to implement and people need more time to discuss them, that's second best, because it's still preferable from going back to war or to violence. And what is happening now is that on some elements of the peace agreement we do see progress. On other elements of the peace agreement, progress is very, very slow in coming. So we are encouraging people to speed up, to live up to their words.
He says that the Netherlands and other donor countries will continue to stand by South Sudan and support the peace process.
If you can give guarantees about implementation and about accountability, we are perfectly happy to help you establish peace in this country because everybody needs it.
Aside from funding health and water management programs, the Dutch embassy in South Sudan is strengthening South Sudan's judicial system, in particular helping victims of sexual violence seek justice.
There is now a gender-based violence court in Juba, operational and active, and we are very happy to see that this court is now also efficient in that they have convicted over the last, I think, week, several people for rape cases, men that have been arrested for raping, especially minors. They are now being apprehended, tried, and convicted. And this is a very important sign, I think, to the population of South Sudan, especially the women.
Since 2013, Van Weyeren says the Dutch government has spent nearly 90 million euros, about $11 million, on flood management, sanitation, drinking water, food security, and humanitarian assistance in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Two bishops from the Episcopal Church of South Sudan were prevented by security forces this week from carrying out pastoral work in Jonglei State. General Joseph Mayen, the Bor County Commissioner, says he only implemented an order by the state governor to shut down two churches in Bor because of recent conflict among bishops from the Episcopal Church of South Sudan. A communication officer at the Episcopal Church of South Sudan accuses some church leaders and Jonglei State government officials of targeting members of the Episcopal Church. For VOA News, Winnie Achayo reports from Juba.
A photo trending on social media shows Bishop Gabriel Thuch Angoth being held by men in reflector jackets who are identified as airport security officials at Bor airstrip, forcing the two bishops to board a plane back to Juba. Right Reverend Zakaria Manyok Biar, Bishop of the Diocese of Wanglei, says he was on a pastoral visit to Bor with Reverend Gabriel Thuch Angoth of Kongor Diocese when the two were stopped by security officials without any clear reason. He says five pastors and three youths allied to defrocked Bishop Akordit were at the airport when they arrived. He says when they stepped out of the plane, one pastor threw a stone at them and another carried a stick. Biar accused Bishop Akordit of sending his team to the airport to attack them.
The people who are loyal to him are the ones who block us from the airport. When we went to the airport, they were protesting. Maybe they wanted to fight us. And the airport officials told us that we should get back into the aircraft to come to Juba. We refused. We said there was no reason why we should go back to Juba. Juba is not our town. We are from Bor, and nobody should deport us.
Pierre says after a long argument with security officials, the plane left them behind. He says they later received a call from Primate Justin Buddy, who told the bishops to return to Juba. Biar says they were traveling back by car when they were ambushed on the Juba Bor Road by security officials he claims were sent by Bishop Akordit.
And the security people were trying to force us back into the aircraft, were actually doing their work so that we could not be harmed. That was it. But we cannot be sure whether they are really doing their work impartially, because they are always siding with Akordit. And we know these things. So when they were forcing us into the aircraft, why would they not arrest the people who want to fight us, if at all they were government people?
Biar says every time Episcopal Church leaders led by Primate Justin Buddy travel to Bor for missions, they are returned to Juba. He says the same thing happened in Bor in October and again in December when some bishops came to Bor for Christmas celebrations. He says police injured two youths who were practicing their songs in Langbar B Parish. Bor County Police Commissioner General Joseph Mayen says he implemented Jonglei State Governor Dinai Jok Changoro's order to shut down the two churches because of the recent conflict between bishops.
The reason was the confusion within the town, security situation, is why they were stopped. And when they came back from Juba, they came without the notice from the state. They were supposed to take permission from the governor.
Maluak Philip Deng, communication officer at Bor Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, denies any pastor from Bishop Akordit's side attacked the bishops at the airport, but says the two violated a recent court order.
They violated the court order that stated the suspension of all the activities related to the case that has been opened in High Court of South Sudan. Second order they violated is the order of the governor. Governor of Jonglei said no any bishop going to Bor until the court hearing is out.
South Sudan in Focus was unable to reach Jonglei Governor Dinai Jok Changor for comment, as he did not reply to text messages or phone calls. The row between Ruben Akordit Ngong, the Archbishop of the Jonglei Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, and Justin Buddy Arama, Primate of the Episcopal Church, began in late 2019 when Akordit created three more dioceses in Jonglei Internal Province and consecrated three bishops without prior approval from Buddy, who also serves as Archbishop of the Metropolitan Diocese of Juba. Buddy suspended Akordit, a move Akordit rejected. In August last year, the Anglican Communion dethroned Akordit. Archbishop Arama appointed Reverend John Panchalcon as the new bishop commissary for Bor. Akordit challenged his dismissal in court. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The world surpasses 100 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 infections, with new coronavirus variants discovered in Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and the United States. Stay tuned for that story after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your biggest regret?
There was a time I beat up my son to the level that he cannot even stand up. So I really pity him, and then I regretted what I did, honestly. And then since then, I have never tried again.
My biggest regret is when I lost my first wife in 2015, 12 June. But thank God, God has given me another beautiful wife.
I don't have any regret. I've actually tuned myself to know that everything that happens in life is for a purpose.
I can't say I've got a biggest regret, but it's all about challenges. I was able to learn from it and manage it so that, I mean, everything will go smoothly.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The Somali Journalist Syndicate, a press freedom group, says at least 14 journalists have been arrested and a radio station attacked in the country in just 3 weeks. The group condemned the latest attacks on media organizations and their workers, which comes as Somalia prepares for parliamentary and presidential elections. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Somali Journalist Syndicate, a press freedom group, says at least 14 journalists have been arrested and a radio station attacked in the country in just 3 weeks. The group condemned the latest attacks on media organizations and their workers, which come as Somalia prepares for parliamentary and presidential elections. Since the beginning of this year, at least 14 journalists have been arrested across Somalia, either for airing views that upset local administrations or for reporting security incidents authorities wanted to keep quiet. Osman Awais Bahar is one of the arrested journalists. Southwest Federal State Security officers stormed his radio station in the town of Barawe, taking him into custody and pulling the FM station off the air. They arrested me because we air the opinions of the public complaining about the bad governance of Barayo town on the radio, Bahar says. I was in jail for 4 days, and the 4 days I was behind bars, the radio was off the air. I was released after elders intervened on the issue, but they told me to continue with my work and to stop airing the voices of those opposing the administration. On Wednesday last week, authorities in Galmudug Federal State arrested two journalists. Abdueli Jama, the director of the Office of President, told VOA that two reporters were arrested for sharing sensitive security details and the president's activities in Puntland State. Jama says these journalists have directly violated media laws and regulations that are preventing the journalists from interfering with the peace of the people. Reporting on something that injures the peaceful existence of the people, he says, if you check their social media pages, they reported something that has effects on the security of the region and its leaders, and this kind of reporting brings a lot of problems. The journalists were released the following day. The Somali Journalist Syndicate, which fights for the rights of journalists and free media, says it is worried about the rising number of detained journalists. Abdallah Ahmed Mu'min is a secretary general of the organization. He says the upcoming elections are a key factor driving the arrests.
There are a lot of uncertainty surrounding this kind of election. Journalists are trying to get the news out and also to feed the information for the public interest. But unfortunately, the authorities do not want to see that. That's why you see they are targeting journalists. They are targeting local radio stations, including the radio in Beletwane. Also, since there are local complaints uprising in various states, the local authorities
the current Somali government mandate ends February 8th with no end in sight. The disagreement over how to conduct the parliamentary and presidential elections. The growing tension has increased the appetite for news, but may lead to further problems for Somali journalists as they try to keep the public informed. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
As the world surpasses 100 million confirmed COVID-19 infections, it's dealing with multiple variants of the original coronavirus that began the pandemic. New coronavirus variants have been discovered in Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and in the western U.S. state of California. What is known about these mutations and what gap in the knowledge base remain? International Edition's Steve Miller speaks to Dr. Zach Jenkins, an associate professor of pharmacy practice with Cedarville University and clinical infectious disease expert with Premier Health Partner in Ohio.
So I think the first thing to understand is that as this pandemic continues to roll onward, we will continue to see more variants. That's inevitable. It just so happens as we have more and more virus circulate and it produces more and more of itself, you start to see these little mutations, these offshoots occur. When it comes to looking at all of these, though, I think probably the way that we can kind of group them together are questions of, well, three big questions. Number one, first off, is it more infectious? And what we're seeing with some of these is that that is true. So the UK variant, for example, is about 70% more infectious than the COVID strain that's been pretty predominant in the United States. Another big question that comes up is, are these more fatal? And some, there's a little bit of debate, I would say, on some of these different elements. The UK B117, which is that variant we've heard a lot about from the United Kingdom, there's some reports suggesting that maybe it is a little bit more fatal than the strain we've had in the US. The third question, though, that I think we kind of have to wrap our heads around is, do these mutations impact our vaccination efforts? And so what's interesting is when you look at all these different variants, a lot of them actually have mutations of the spike protein, which is what, at least for the vaccines in the United States, we've been targeting for our primary vaccine methods. So to date, the good news is the vaccines seem to be holding out against the variants as far as what's been studied. We know that the Pfizer vaccine seems to be active against the South African strain and the UK strain. And the Moderna vaccine did show some activity as well, although they've actually noted that it was a little bit more blunted in their response with the South African variant. So what they're suggesting that they may do is create a booster shot where they can actually start to protect against these other variants. So that's going to be an ongoing discussion as we continue to see these different variants emerge.
Dr. Jenkins, you mentioned that you are not surprised that there have been different variants of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. There are also different strains of the seasonal flu. Is this something that is analogous to that?
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways in that, you know, the flu tends to emerge every year. We see a lot of different variants. And what we do with the vaccine is we typically predict the most likely variants that we'll see. As you're probably aware, many people are probably aware, the vaccine with the flu is typically not 100% successful. It's usually around 50% or maybe less. And the reason for that is there are so many variants, and the flu happens to mutate very rapidly. The nice thing about the COVID virus in comparison is that it doesn't mutate quite as quickly. But even so, we're still seeing these mutants emerge.
So that's what we know about the coronavirus variants. In your opinion, where are our knowledge gaps? What don't we know?
It's a great question. I think there's some big questions we have to kind of think about with these variants, not only with infectivity rates and mortality, but are any of them more prone to triggering certain kinds of immune responses? So it's kind of expanding on that question of mortality. You know, we've known, for example, with COVID that it does cause a lot of blood clots. One thing we might start to ask ourselves as well, are any of these variants worse when it comes to that? Do the symptoms appear in greater frequency with certain variants than with others? So those are things we'll have to think about. And why that's an important question for us is it will drive drug development.
That's Dr. Zach Jenkins, an associate professor of pharmacy practice with Cedarville University and clinical infectious disease expert with Premier Health Partner in Ohio. He was speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Still on COVID-19, for most of the past year, Africa appeared to be doing better in containing the coronavirus pandemic than many wealthier nations. However, as South Africa and several other nations on the continent undergo a surge in infections, many experts think Africa's lower numbers may actually reflect lower testing rates, systemic underreporting, and other factors. VOA's Adam Phillips has this report.
Professor Yap Boom is the regional representative for Epicenter Africa, the research arm of Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières. Speaking from Cameroon, Boom said there are several reasons why COVID-19 statistics have tended to skew low on the continent.
To start with, most countries were actually targeting the people who had symptoms. While we've understood that in Africa, up to 80% of the positive COVID patients are asymptomatic. So there was a bunch of people that were not being screened because they were not asymptomatic.
Boom and his colleagues are trying to determine the actual prevalence of exposure to the virus by taking large numbers of blood samples in places like outdoor markets, large workplaces, and within extended families.
So we have started a survey in Congo, we'll be doing in Senegal, Cameroon, quite a number of other countries. And that will give us a better picture of how those countries have been affected.
The results have been sobering. For example, in Yaoundé, Cameroon's capital, the percentage of people known to have been exposed to the virus has risen 32%, while in Cape Town, South Africa, the number has soared as high as 60%. Those numbers dwarf the percentage of people testing positive on the PCR test, the most reliable test for active infection, and an antigen test that detects coronavirus antibodies in the system, which indicates prior exposure. But many Africans are not being tested at all. That could be because they lack the transportation or the time to get to a health facility, or because many health facilities do not test for COVID-19 if a patient shows no symptoms, such as coughing, shortness of breath, fever, and the loss of taste or smell.
So even if a test is done, maybe the data doesn't get to the level it needs to for the reporting to happen.
Tiffany Harris is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center's ICAP Global Health Group in New York and the director of its Department of Strategic Information.
South Africa, which does have a much stronger surveillance system compared to the rest of the continent, we are seeing large number of cases, and we have for some time. That's probably also a sign that the other countries, there's undercounts there. In neighboring countries like Zimbabwe, for example, the cases are dramatically increasing there. And Zambia is also seeing a surge in cases.
Keeping reliable COVID infection rates is key. But so are accurate death records, which require testing, autopsies, and proper facilities. Many countries in Africa do not automatically register deaths. In those that do, registrations may be delayed months.
And so a common approach is to look at what often referred to as all-cause mortality. In the absence of something else that's going on, if we're seeing big rises in all-cause mortality over the same year, you could surmise that it's probably either direct effects of COVID or even indirect effects of COVID.
Harris says that to gain control of the pandemic, Africa will need better surveillance and testing and rigorous contact tracing, along with lab support and the widespread distribution of vaccines. She adds that the recruitment of healthcare workers to educate the public and treat the sick is also crucial. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
We love to hear what you think about this show. Send us your brief comments about issues in our news or what is happening in your area. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We will air your comments every Friday. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Noma Kanji by Brenda Fassie. Listening to Brenda Fassie with the song Noma Kanji. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.